Don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on October 15th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, special guest Matt Christman joins me and Nate for our 200th episode to talk about the future of immigration, borders, trade deals, and globalism under climate change, and what the left's answer to the fascist response should be. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. It's Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me as usual in studio this week is Nate. Hey, Nate, welcome back.
Great to be here, Bill.
And joining us on the line for our 200th episode, we have special guest Matt Christman from the Chapo Trap House podcast. Hey, Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we previously on the show had Felix on, your co-host on that show, to talk about Saudi Arabia. We've got you on to talk about, I guess, Marxism in the 21st century. How would you describe, before we get into that, how would you describe sort of where you come from on these issues and the background and that sort of thing?
Oh, I try not to think of myself in any kind of rigorously labeled terms. I just sort of someone who views the current hellscape through a general Marxist lens, at least in analysis, and just sort of sees where that takes me, as opposed to sort of feeling like I'm part of a coherent tendency.
I think that's probably fine for our purposes today, because a lot of it we're just trying to come up with sort of what the overall Marxian view on some of these big questions would be. So the sort of four themes that I think we're going to be talking about today, and they all very, very closely relate together, as you've talked about sometimes on your podcast. We've got first kind of what the possible responses are to climate change from the various elements of the political spectrum. We've got the issue of left globalism, sort of what would a left solidarity look like in the 21st century. We've got the issue of trade deals, kind of rethinking that and what, you know, economic relationships would look like from a sort of Marxian driven perspective instead of the multinational corporations. And then finally, immigration issues, which I think, you know, as some people will already be seeing where we're going with this, that's something that obviously ties into climate change, because the issue of climate change is going to create a lot of or exacerbate a lot of refugee problems and things like that, or just economic collapses in the global south. And so how we respond to these type of issues, it's all going to relate together on all of these things. And so one thing that made me think, oh, you'd be a good person to have on the show for this, was that kind of in passing on one of the episodes of your show, you had mentioned you were kind of putting it all together in a grand unified theory of like where these white supremacists are reemerging from the woodwork and why now. And you kind of said, you know, they're looking ahead and they're recognizing that like there's going to be some sort of a fundamental transformation as a result of sort of the collapsing order, especially due to climate change. But their sort of response to it is like the worst possible response. But that's not to say that the other responses are necessarily good either. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that to kind of get us started on this.
Yeah, the basic premise of that conversation is that these white supremacist guys, the Richard Spencers, are really the tip of a spear point of rising awareness that ecological catastrophe will cause such a disastrous reduction in resources that the people of Earth are going to be, basically, we're not going to be able to exist in this sort of nation state concept anymore, because huge chunks of the world are going to become unlivable and not arable anymore. And that's going to lead to food scarcity, water scarcity. People aren't going to be able to sustain themselves where they're currently living. And there are a bunch of different responses to that. And the white supremacists are the ones who see that one of the most tempting for people in sort of what they consider their people who live in the comfort of first world living standards and who feel entitled to those will be to try to essentially allow those people to die to prevent them from coming to places where there are more resources and also prevent resources from being redistributed to them in other parts of the world. And that is a horrifying thing to think about allowing to happen unless you have created a ideological structure that justifies it, unless you have brought to bearing ideas of racial inferiority and cultural inferiority and cultural incompatibility to say to people who might not otherwise be fervently racist that it's basically not tenable to help these people. These people basically have to be allowed to die. It's not our fault. This thing happening with the cooking of the earth basically is no single individual's responsibility. What we do have is responsibilities to our families and to our nations to maintain their stability and maintain their sense of identity. And if people have to die in other countries, if foreigners, if strangers, if people with bad cultures and low IQs have to die, then so be it. And I think one of the reasons that you see such a large number of ex-libertarians among the alt-right is because libertarianism is devoted to maintaining current property relationships. And the smarter libertarians, the more far-seeing libertarians realize in the future that will require genocide or genocide by neglect. And as such, they either stopping libertarians if they have humanity within them, or they accept that premise and take the next step towards embracing the sort of racial nationalism that will justify the coming culling of the herd, basically.
Now, this is obviously sort of the really dark response pathway to climate change, which, as you said, is they're getting us ready for genocide as the answer to, you know, the impacts of climate change. The way I see it, there are probably two other, broadly speaking, responses to this. One is sort of this neoliberal response where you increasingly place your trust in corporations to distribute the resources and make decisions, and these giant conglomerates would sort of probably ultimately replace government in terms of like deciding who lives or dies. And they wouldn't necessarily pursue active genocide, but they would probably allow a lot of people to die by just not giving them the resources. And then there's this sort of left pathway where probably a large state would be essentially deciding how to equitably ration and distribute resources and make sure that people don't die. And there's going to be probably some element of coercion there always is with government, but that it's a more benevolent sort of way of distributing resources that makes sure that it's not based on your gender or identity or religion or ethnicity. I mean, do you see other pathways, or is that pretty much the sort of three probably primary strands of where we go from here?
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that the second one, the neoliberal one, will end in the same genocide. It just won't be explicitly racialized. It won't have the ideological sheen to it. It won't have the aesthetic armament of conventional fascism. But it will in the end involve walls and restrictions on immigration and the malign neglect of places dying from and no longer environmentally sustainable, because it will still be capitalism. It will still be organized around the profit motive, organized around capital accumulation, and there will be no mechanism whereby people without capital, people without any influence in the market, people that capitalism as it has now been matured across the world they don't really have use for, because there's no use for them as consumers. You could argue, well, they always need more consumers, but in a landscape of reduced resources, that might not be the case. And with automation, they're certainly not needed as workers. And so in a capitalist context, these people are surplus in every meaningful sense. And so there will be no, and since they will not have the influence or mechanism to demand attention, I don't see any way that the neoliberal solution, quote unquote, ends any differently, unless, of course, there's the Hail Mary scientific advancement that saves us all from the worst results of climate change, which is, of course, you know, that's the X factor that everybody is sort of subconsciously hoping for, even though that's madness. So I'd say, yeah, it really boils down to two differences. The old boring formula laid out by Rosa Luxemburg, socialism or barbarism, whether we call it fascism or we call it neoliberal corporate engagement with the world, the end result will be that people who cannot eat and have no labor to input into the system will be ignored until they're no longer there to have to worry about. So the real solution is the one where capitalism is overturned and goods are distributed according to need rather than profit.
I guess the distinction that I'm seeing between the sort of far right and neoliberal pathways there is that one involves like active death squads saying that only white people get the resources. The other involves saying, oh, well, if you have money, then you get the resources. If you don't have money, then you don't get the resources. And then we're just going to like shove you as far out of sight as possible until you die on your own, and sort right. of just starving people out like that.
Yeah, it's basically just a difference of whether the people carrying it out have willfully embraced an ideology of death, or have just passively accepted it as a consequence of the more important ideology, which of course is capitalism.
Yeah, Matt, I was wondering what your thoughts on sort of almost the beginnings of this post the sort of refugee crisis in Europe. You see walls going up in, say, Hungary, various migrant camps, and sort of the rise of all these far-right parties. In fact, I think just today in Austria, there was an election where the Freedom Party, formerly founded by Nazis, did quite well. So just this sort of fits into the sort of structure you're laying out here.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that we see everywhere that people are faced with these choices, are choosing a coherent activist response. Because that's really what we have now, is we have a situation where the neoliberal alternative is incoherent and basically isn't really even spelled out as a set of policies, because that's sort of its nature, is that it's this amorphous status quo that just persists of its own momentum. And when people feel like they are in a crisis of some kind, coherent alternatives and coherent critiques are going to be more persuasive. And right now, the most coherent and most forcefully made critiques of this are from the far right.
Do you think that the left hasn't really stepped up either at this point? That's been a lot of my feeling. I mean, on this show, we've talked a lot about specific things that could be done, like buying the U.S. oil and gas industry as one way of helping to accelerate responses to this. You know, as you said, if there's an active response, which is fascism, and then there's sort of a dithering non-response, like, I mean, does it seem like the left is kind of missing in action on this issue?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is that the left basically doesn't exist in the way that we're used to thinking about it when we talk about it historically, specifically in the 20th century. the 19th and 20th century, the sort of labor-based, multiracial, working-class movement. It kind of doesn't exist anymore. The working class has been fractured into a million pieces, and there is no real umbrella organization that has stepped forward to bring them back together. And that's not really, I mean, that's not the fault specifically of any leftist or leftist group. I mean, the headwinds are so powerfully against the left and have been. We are seeing that things may be starting to change on that front. We're seeing people more receptive, certainly younger people, to ideas of socialism. And I think part of the problem, though, is that we're not really putting it in the terms that it needs to be put into. We need to forcefully point out to the people who are rightfully horrified by the Richard Spencers of the world and by Nazis marching in the street that the tepid neoliberalism of maybe the candidate that they voted for at a local level or for president is not in any way up to the task of defeating that. And in many ways shares a lot of the same undergirding assumptions as them. We need to let people of conscience know that there really is only the left as an alternative to these forces, as the first step towards pushing beyond the sort of fractured issue-based leftism that we see now to something that's much more broader.
And if an active response to climate change requires some sort of command and control economic way of organizing things, then it's either going to come from the far right or it's going to come from the left. And we would much prefer it to be from the left. This sort of self-perpetuating status quo from the center is never going to come up fast enough with the like state enterprise and state, even state capitalism, arguably, to deal with this sort of transitional period, even in the best case scenario of like getting us to a clean energy for all future on a time scale that can make any difference whatsoever to the level of damage that we're going to experience from climate change.
Yeah. And I think one way to point that out is to show people, okay, These status quo neoliberals are basically putting all their eggs in the technological basket. And look at Silicon Valley, which is America's hotbed of innovation. And what have their actual innovations been in the past 10 years? It's basically just a bunch of technical elements that allow them to arbitrage local regulations in order to undercut traditional business models and make profits that way, or not even make profits. Most of them don't even make money. And just they're kept going by the fact that there is a massive, massive pool of venture capital because 1% of people in the world own basically all of the wealth, which means they have all that money to just throw after good after bad to companies like Uber with only the slightest hint that they might ever get any of it back. Because what else are they going to do with it? There's only so many ivory back scratchers you can buy. And all of that venture capital has bought a bunch of apps and juice machines that do the same work as human hands.
Yeah.
We're not seeing any kind of big, even guys like Musk are more, the fact that Elon Musk has repeatedly said that he is the guy who's going to create the battery power or the energy solution or the transportation solution that's going to get us out of this. But he's also spending all that time trying to figure out how he can escape to Mars. That should tell you how much faith you should have in any of these technological solutions.
And doing stuff like trying to build an infeasible Hyperloop instead of actually electrifying the, you know, rail system that we have, or having high speed rail that would, you know, eliminate some of the fossil fuel transportation on the, you know, the highways.
Right, because the vision is to create essentially a privatized infrastructure for the small core of remaining rich people to exist. Basically, if you can't go to Mars, bring Mars to Earth, in that you create these isolated compounds and pods of luxury that can be connected to by privatized infrastructure.
It always reminded me of the in the Hunger Games series, especially you could see in the movies that like they had this high speed rail maglev system all over this mm-hmm. country that basically two or three people a year would get to use. And it was,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it's ludicrous, but that's kind of what they're going for. Nate?
I think I just saw either today or yesterday a proposal from Airbnb to just create standalone apartments. And someone's like, yeah, you just invented the hotel. So congratulations.
Yeah, and this is on the heels of Lyft reinventing the bus.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
One of the other things that, you know, we've alluded to a little bit so far, but that I've been a little concerned with how some leftists talk about it. And I'm not painting with a broad brush here. I think there's a lot of disagreement on how to talk about it. But the immigration issue has obviously been like very heated because that's a huge issue that Trump is stoking. And it's something that obviously makes a lot of people very upset or anxious in this country, often with the wrong response. But occasionally you hear leftists sort of leaning into some of that rhetoric about that, you know, that if we don't impose these controls, there's going to be this endless tide of migrants coming to the country and taking the jobs. And that's going to, you know, undercut our unions, what little we have, blah, blah, blah. And one of the things that I remember hearing you say at one point, I think on the podcast, was that there is a danger that some, you know, self-styled leftists will, instead of offering a left vision for how to deal with that issue, will instead kind of try to borrow some of the right-wing rhetoric, and that's only going to make the situation worse.
Oh, absolutely, because the temptation is going to be very strong, because it's so much harder to try to underline things, elements, dynamics that are sort of hidden from discourse and bring them to the surface and get people to recognize them than it is to just ride the wave of existing prejudices. That's the easiest thing in the world to do. And yeah, so the temptation is always going to be there to just basically, because people talk about the need for socialists to, quote, meet people where they are. And that's true. But the danger of taking that too literally is that you then meet people at their worst places and decide to just work with the prejudices that already exist instead of trying to create a framework that is appealing and broadly attractive, and then seeing if that undermines it. I mean, I think that it's tough, but I think it can be done. One of the most obvious, I mean, I'm generally a very pessimistic person about the future and about the possibilities for electoral politics. But one of the most heartening things I saw in the last year was during the last general election in the UK, when Labour was able to wipe out previous areas of UKIP strongholds during Corbyn's campaign, where because he ran an explicitly hostile to racist campaign, a campaign that did not fearmonger around immigration, and they were able to hugely reduce UKIP turnout in a lot of these in a lot of districts and take that for Labour. Without doing that, without sort of catering to prejudices, by promoting the idea of broad social democracy. So I think it can be done. It's just difficult. And it obviously puts you at a huge disadvantage vis-a-vis the media, as we know from the UK and the United States as well. But it's really the only way, because otherwise you just end up like Gregor Strasser and, you know, they beat you to death with your own glasses or whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, that example aside, I mean, just more recently in terms of what you were saying with Labour and everything, like, obviously, you know, in Austria, the center-left party's response to all this was to start adopting very, like, nationalistic, right-wing kind of rhetoric, and anti-immigration rhetoric. We saw that in Australia. Denmark, the party, you know, which they're actually the prime minister there from the former prime minister now from the Social Democrats is actually married to a like new Labour type person in the UK, an MP. But, you know, she adopts this like we have to have sensible controls on immigration in Denmark. And, you know, then the party gets wiped out. And it's like, well, what, you know, what exactly did you accomplish there? To the UK example more specifically, I actually went through after the election there and looked at the immigration language in the manifesto from this year, from 2 years ago, from 5 years before that. And I mean, you know, under the Gordon Brown election effort, I mean, that was just openly right-wing, hostile to immigration rhetoric. And for some reason, you know, the anti-Corbyn people keep on trying to suggest that because of the complexities around the EU exit, that somehow that means that he's anti-immigration and that he's, you know, shamefully not countering this rhetoric from the UKIP type people and whatever. But as you said, he did really well with this manifesto that's substantially more favorable to immigrants and doesn't, you know, play around with that language of like we have to have reasonable controls to protect our jobs or whatever. It's openly like immigrants are part of our community and our country and our nation. They're going to be, you know, and not even saying in the sense of like they're adding value to our economy, which is sort of the like compromise approach that some of the, you know, center leftists will take.
Types.
Yeah.
And the thing is that it works because you're not just saying, because what the neolibs will do is they'll say immigrants make us stronger and they're better for us, but then they don't have any answer. Well, okay, my life sucks. I feel like my children's lives are more prescribed. I feel like I'm not getting anywhere. All you can't just say immigrants are not the problem, because that leaves the question of, well, who is? And that is one of the main things that will doom the neoliberal project over the next decades is it has no answer to that question. Whereas the Corbyn-led labor campaign said, immigrants are not the problem. Immigrants are part of the community. If you want to look at who is making your life miserable, it is the corrupt political establishment and the ruling class. And you have to have that answer to the question of why things suck, or else people are going to say, all right, okay, you're saying these people aren't the problem, but you're basically acting like there isn't a problem. You're saying, as one amazingly eloquent hat said, America is already great. That's not a persuasive rhetoric. It just can't be.
That was the moment where I thought that the campaign was in very deep trouble. I mean, I was already skeptical anyway. And then I think, as you did, we all kind of blocked it out toward the end of just thinking, well, it's not possible that they're going to lose. But I mean, at that point, the writing was on the wall, so we should have all accepted it.
Yeah. No, I remember at the time when that hat came out, I thought she's going to lose. And then I basically spent the next 6 months convincing myself that my instincts were wrong.
Arsenal for Democracy and WVUD will be back in just a moment to talk about the future of trade deals and globalism. Please stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. On the line for our 200th episode, we have special guest Matt Christman from the Chapo Trap House podcast to talk about the future of immigration, borders, trade deals, and globalism under climate change, and what the left's answer to the fascist response should be. So we've been talking about this immigration issue for a bit now, and earlier, actually, in, you know, at the beginning of this interview, you mentioned kind of in passing, as just a sort of throwaway line, that as a result of climate change, you know, and large areas of the world becoming uninhabitable, whether it's desertification or floods or sea level or whatever, a lot of areas are going to be uninhabitable. There's going to be a lot of migration. Economic collapses will definitely add to that in many places. And I think that's a likely thing, especially the more time that goes on without acting. But you said as a result of that, sort of the current notions of national borders, nation state sovereignty is kind of going to go away. And I think that leads us into another one of these themes that I wanted to talk about, which is kind of what would left globalism look like in the 21st century? Because sort of a really quotable line that everyone knows from sort of Marxist thought is that, you know, workers of the world unite, you know, you have nothing to lose but your chains. And there was this period before World War I where there was this kind of really strong thought that maybe there could be this sort of worldwide socialist revolution. And then after, you know, the socialism in one nation policies get brought in certain places, which you can understand, I guess, from a historical standpoint of like they decided what they had to do at the time. But it kind of, after a while, that dream sort of faded away. And we went back to this sort of, even whether you were a communist or a capitalist, this nation state model that's kind of stuck around in some form or another since Westphalia kind of gets locked in and continues to be seen as the status quo. But as you're saying, a lot of that is going to be challenged. And I think a lot of it's already been challenged because between various trade deals, which we'll talk about later as well, and between, you know, these drone strikes happening everywhere without regard to anything, and U.S. troops being deployed anywhere in the world. To some extent, these lines are already blurring, but where do you see the future of, like, borders and nation states going, and what should be the leftist vision for this that counters either the sort of the borderless vision of some of the more, you know, capitalist people, or the very, very hard borders and walls approach of the fascists?
Basically, globalism has to be redefined, because the people who have that acrid taste in their mouth when they say globalist, I mean, a lot of them are just anti-Semites. A lot of them are just good old-fashioned American racists and ethno-nationalists. But I think there's a larger chunk who are rightfully suspicious of global ambitions, because they've seen it in a capitalist context where globalism means capital can go anywhere, and it can find any kind of the perfect ratio of automation in some countries and low wages in others to maximize profits and reduce standards of living for regular people. And so they are rightfully suspicious of any move to get rid of national borders, which they see as protecting them from the worst deprivations of capitalism. So I think that the first step is going to be redefining globalism to mean a global movement among workers to overthrow capitalist control of means of production. And that's old-fashioned, obviously, and corny in a way, but it really is the only vision that can allows for the humanity of all people to be respected and attended to when crisis strikes and when when climate change wreaks havoc, and also means that capital will not be there to direct the flow of resources away from people, which is what it has been doing until now. It has to be a recognition that you have more in common, that we have more in common with each other at the basic level of people who seek decent standard of living and chances for our children and all that stuff. We have more in common on that basic level as regular people than any of us do with a transnational ruling class who dream of infant blood and Mars colonies and basically detaching from the rest of us. And that what they've basically been doing in the last 30 years is hyper-accumulating capital amongst themselves so that they have literally all of it, basically, at this point. And that they are using it to create a parallel private states with the resources that are the birthright of all people. And that there's so much we could do with all of this privately hoarded capital. There is so much we could do to alleviate climate change, to restructure energy economies, to alleviate hyper pockets of poverty. But it all starts with the assumption that these resources have to be redistributed and across the globe, a global redistribution of capital. And I think a lot of people in first world countries get worried about that because they think, oh, they're coming for my stuff. They're coming for my split level. And, you know, I don't think there's any future, any humane future that doesn't involve people's lifestyles being changed in some ways. The amount of waste in the American, the amount of food waste, the amount of energy waste in the first world is genuinely nauseating and not sustainable. But so much of it is linked into the need to extract profit. And if we redefine that, basically the terms of conflict from between us or in our borders with our walls and this fearful other and everybody and this parasitic sliver of humanity that has taken all the resources to themselves and basically is cooking the earth in its own juices in order to create hyper exploitation and hyper accumulation, then maybe that could be the start of people looking beyond borders in a way that is not, that does not instinctively make them feel threatened and make them feel like someone else is going to get their job or something like that, because they realize that the enemy there is not people in other countries. It's the same small group of people who run every country.
Traditionally, for people who had been pushing from the business side of things as opposed to like the cultural side or whatever, if they'd been pushing something, a project like the European Union or some other, you know, union like that, they were always traditionally pushing freedom of movement, which in their minds was not that everyone gets to exchange, you know, cultures and move around and build families across borders. It was more about, you know, making sure that low-wage labor can come into their countries. And then where that's not possible, you have freedom of moving the factories in the other direction. But as you said earlier, you know, the way this climate change stuff is going to work out, yeah, the fascists are going to be pushing for these giant walls and border controls. But ultimately, so are the neoliberals in the end, that they're going to have to implement certain border measures to prevent these, you know, what they once touted as, oh, we can have all these low wage workers coming in. They're going to at some point hit the panic button and put back up those walls. And this sort of hand wavy explanation from the capitalists has always been, oh, well, the way to keep people from wanting to come to this country or, you know, or wanting to come to Europe is to increase economic opportunities at home or whatever. And that it's always really vague and you kind of question how they're actually going to do it. But I'm wondering, again, sort of what's this third alternative from the left? Like, how do we envision something that doesn't involve, you know, these really fascist border setups, but also does provide a way for people to you know, continue living where they are so that we're not necessarily locked into the same old nation state and border conventions that we're used to, but that by the same token, we're also not just having everyone all move to one place, because ultimately that's not really an answer either.
No, it's not an answer. And the thing is, it's not something that anybody wants either. The right-wing model of immigration is that the people who come to these countries are doing so with some nefarious purpose.
Or jealousy.
They're doing it because they want to undermine the West because of some cultural grievance or racial grievance. And the fact is they're doing it because they need to survive. Most people would rather stay where they have cultural comfort, where they have family, where they have those kind of community bonds. That's where people in general would rather live. And so the idea that in the absence of this sort of horrifyingly unequal distribution of resources and climate catastrophes and warfare caused by the climate catastrophes, that these people would still be in some sort of suicide mission to destroy the West is absurd. People don't want to go anywhere. Ideally, people want to live among the people that they grew up with. And there's nothing wrong with that. And giving people the option of staying is really one of the benefits of redistributing wealth more broadly. And you do it by developing these places, but not in the way that has meant by neoliberals, which means plumping down a giant factory and putting up suicide nets.
There has to be something other than just saying that a country is now developed because they are also matching the GDP output, you know, per capita or the carbon emissions per capita of a developed nation. There has to be some sort of like clean and shiny vision for what that actually looks like, where people are not poor anymore and they can work and live in their communities or do whatever in their communities and survive and not be on the brink.
Yes. And I think it comes down to applying the technological advances that we have seen and using them for the general good as opposed to the private good. That's one of the reasons that you're going to see less and less in the future talk by these Silicon Valley types about how immigrants, they're good for us. I mean, how much is Silicon Valley going to care about immigration once they've automated coding, for example? How much is any industry going to care about being able to get relatively cheap labor from other countries when they've automated their industries? That thing is going to make everybody basically obsolete. And that means you need to reframe the economy away from work and from contributing like that. And that the good news about that is that means that you could do that everywhere. You could bring automation that frees people around the world, and instead of concentrating it at the places where there's the highest degree of economic development and then using that to reduce wages, which is what it's done so far.
Now, I do want to talk about trade deals a bit. Before I kind of give my background thoughts on why I was thinking of bringing that into the conversation, Nate, you were noting before about kind of that there seems to be a narrative shift on politically on trade deals.
Yeah, it was interesting just in this past election to see a fair amount of talk about, you know, TPP and other trade deals compared to past election cycles where that was barely an issue at all. And it was interesting how Trump was sort of able to invert the issue a little bit while you had Obama going out stumping for the TPP in the middle of the campaign.
I guess it's a consensus cracking, basically, yeah, after, you know, 15 or so years of that. The reason that I was thinking of bringing this up now, for by way of background, for folks who aren't familiar with what I do for work, I work as a senior editor at a publication called The Globalist. That's one reason why I was bringing
globalist.
Up the issue of the word globalist, right? Because, you know, it's existed for quite a while at this point. It doesn't, it's not a neoliberal publication for the most part. There's obviously elements that I don't agree with and I don't work on those things. But a lot of it is kind of this more traditional social democratic European perspective about, you know, meeting people's basic material needs. Obviously, it's fairly pro-capitalist, but it's also interestingly been pretty critical of a lot of these trade deals, which I find really interesting that they'll be promoting a lot of stuff that you would expect from that kind of a publication and then also be very critical of TPP, or especially the proposed TTIP, which is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Protocols proposal that would put the U.S., I think Canada, and the European Union, including the U.K., into sort of one big trade deal. Now, the publication is actually based in Germany now. It used to be in D.C., and so a lot of this stuff has always been from this sort of German perspective, which is an interesting way of looking at it. And the German perspective overwhelmingly has been hostile to the TTIP proposal for an EU-US deal because the U.S. is seen as basically like one of these third world countries where it's so backward that it would drag everyone in Europe down. which is not the way we're used to thinking of it when we're talking about, you know, dealing with workers' rights and environmental issues and that sort of thing from the U.S. perspective. But basically, like, there are a lot of Germans, you know, German intellectuals who are very seriously concerned that any EU-US trade deal would result in all of the consumer safety protection measures and labor rights that are secured in the EU and have been for decades being thrown out the window in favor of whatever lowest common denominator the U.S. has established. You know, historically, in the past, like, obviously there's a neoliberal argument for a lot of those safeguards from the EU perspective, which is just standardization. You know, if you have a standardized that everyone in the EU has to get 20 days of paid leave, now you can have an international corporation operating in multiple countries and they know exactly how much paid leave they have to give to everyone. So those things are not necessarily done benevolently for the benefit of the workers. Same thing goes with like paid maternity leave allowances, that sort of thing. A lot of it is just about standardizing. But by the same token, you know, the standardizations have definitely immensely benefited a lot of the people in the European Union. And that would be something like my ideal sort of US-EU trade deal would just be adopting all of these existing safeguards that are used in the EU and just plunking that down in the United States and then not making the EU adopt any of the US rules. But that's probably not going to happen. But this does lead us to this question of like, what are the economic relations between countries going to be and between workers going to be under a sort of more leftist vision of things? Is there a way of doing a genuinely leftist trade deal that's not just saying, oh, here's one provision in the trade deal that supposedly protects workers and will never be enforced? Is there a way of, you know, organizing all of these sort of trade deals explicitly around workers, international worker solidarity, workers' rights, things like that, or even just the labor theory of value from Marxism, like the determining factor as opposed to, you know, GDP things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's possible, but basically it would require changing the units of negotiation. Right now, when these deals are negotiated, they're basically the parties involved are the corporate leaders and political leaders, and the degree to which those are even different of these countries negotiating amongst themselves with minimal input from organized labor or voters, for that matter, because most of the negotiations are carried on in secret. You would have to basically see negotiations between countries at the level of workers, negotiations where corporate power is no longer in the driver's seat of setting policy, where organized labor, hopefully a regenerated organized labor, a broadly inclusive and influential labor movement is actually at the table, is actually at the head of the table. And I think if you had that, and those are the people negotiating with each other, and you've basically cut out or severely reduced the influence of corporate leadership, I think you could actually get to a point where you're negotiating on the premise of what deal will maximize the livelihoods of actual people in these countries, as opposed to what will maximize profits.
Do you feel that there's been any answer from the left really on these sort of trade relationships other than just rejecting the very bad proposals that are coming down? I mean, that's been kind of my concern, is like that people will say no to these deals, which I agree with, but then I'm not hearing a like, this is what an actual like left solidarity would look like if we had control of the government. And certainly none of the Democrats in the US are pushing that, but you get this kind of like, there, I mean, there's like a cosmopolitan segment of the electorate that thinks that, you know, unless someone else is making a counter case on how to do internationalism, then this is what internationalism must be, and I support that because that's a good thing. I'm just not hearing this kind of like alternative being floated.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the reason for that is just because of the left's weakness. Because to imagine genuinely emancipatory fair trade labor trade negotiations, you have to, as I said, imagine a government negotiating on behalf of workers as opposed to on behalf of corporations. And that seems so far away that it's almost, I think for a lot of people, it feels almost beside the point to even imagine it. You're living in the here and now, and in the here and now, trade negotiations are carried out by corporations in conjunction with governments. And as such, there's really no way they can ever reflect the needs and desires of working people. And that's just the reality of international trade right now. And in that context, the only real response to these deals is to just oppose them. I do think part of building an alternative is the broader strategy, is part of the broader project that I was talking about, of being just vastly more ambitious. I think the key to a lot of this, the key to bringing together workers, the key to bringing together people from across borders and challenging these notions, it's just you have to think bigger. And I understand, as I said earlier, why the left hasn't thought bigger. There's been a systematic reduction of its influence and power over the years, and it's been scattered and fractured and pushed through a million different distracting filters. And that leaves people in these situations where they're focused on specific issues that affect them specifically. And that makes sense. And why not? Because that's the only place that they can see any movement possible is in their lives around them. But I think the first step towards bringing them people back together is to think big again. And part of that will be imagining things as broad and in the current context seemingly impossible as working people negotiating trade deals. And so, yeah, I just think that it's really a failure of imagination, an understandable failure of imagination, but one that's going to have to be addressed.
I'm not that familiar with sort of the early socialist and Marxist literature, but was that something that was ever really discussed? Because, of course, at the time, you know, the turn of the last century was sort of the first wave of, like, signing these free trade deals and having this movement pushing for free trade deals. What was there any sort of discussion of this? Because a lot of these trade deals are basically misapplying Adam Smith research on like agrarian economies, where you're like, okay, this country can grow wine grapes and this country is really good at doing sheep, so they should both concentrate on one or the other, but we're not arbitraging the like waged labor between them, which seems to be the focus of all the late, you know, subsequent trade deals really. Was there any sort of imagination along those lines of what a worker-centered like economic trade relationship would be?
Well, Marx in the 40s and in the 50s and 60s, when he lived in England, was pro free trade, because he felt like it would accelerate the capitalist crisis that would bring about the end of capitalism.
So accelerationism.
He was absolutely. He was in the aftermath of the, in the direct aftermath of the 48 revolutions, he was pretty much convinced that there was going to be another economic catastrophe in the near future, and it would bring about the end of capitalism. And of course, that he changed that and got more. And that's kind of the failure of that to materialize is sort of what led him towards his more in-depth examination of exactly how capitalism reproduces itself, because it did it what he thought was going to happen didn't happen. But I think that I'm not familiar too familiar with that literature. But I think for the most part, by the time you saw real mature Marxist-led labor movements in the West, they weren't thinking in terms of trade deals, because they were honestly thinking in terms of incipient global revolution. They really thought, and this is what the Bolsheviks were essentially banking on when they seized the Winter Palace in 1917, was that worldwide socialist revolution was going to happen. And at the end of it, you would have a workers' control essentially of the globe. And that in that context, things like trade deals would sort of be superfluous, because you saw before World War One, you saw the Second International sort of at its height, and it was destroyed basically when World War One broke out, and many of the socialist parties of Europe decided to support their country's war effort instead of international solidarity. That was really a huge blow. But then as World War One became this horrifying meat grinder that just destroyed a generation, and then the Russian Revolution happened, there was this brief period, this brief tipping point from about 1917 to about 1921, when people really, throughout Europe, really felt like the revolution was about to happen. And you saw things like the Bavarian revolution, the Spartacist Bavarian revolution, and the Hungarian Soviet Union, and things like that. And then the Russian invasion of Poland. And then when that didn't happen, then you saw, as you said earlier, this reversion to the idea of socialism in one country. And over time, what became very apparent is that socialism is incompatible with being integrated into a nation state framework of trade, because it basically forces you to operate on the level of state capitalism,
right,
in order to trade internationally, which you have to do.
Yeah, I was going to say something that I've talked about on the show before is that even in the United States at the time, there was this constitutional convention in Massachusetts, which was originally convened in the middle of 1917. And then they kind of didn't really come to any agreement in the summer of 1917 on what they wanted to do. And they were, you know, it was part of the progressive movement, so it was mostly pretty bland, like we should be able to do initiative petitions, things like that. But then they took a recess and came back the next year in 1918. And this was after the events in, you know, October Revolution in Russia and the, you know, war starting to, like, it was clear where the war was going, or, you know, that it was going to wind down at that point, and that a lot of these countries were either definitely going to collapse or were on the brink of collapse. The rhetoric completely changes, even in the United States. You start having, you know, open syndicalist delegates at that convention saying, or trade unionist guys saying, you know, I'm not a syndicalist personally, but, you know, the guys that I know in my union at the local union hall, they're going to stage a syndicalist coup or revolution and replace the U.S. government with a union-run government or whatever, unless you concede to these demands, you know. And then they would say we should have universal public housing and things like that. So that's something, like, it's a kind of interesting artifact of a very specific time where you can see this sense for a very brief moment that, like, everything is going to change everywhere worldwide. And that didn't really happen. And, you know, the reactionary forces kind of gain the upper hand and start doing the first Red Scare there. But I always think that's kind of an interesting example of where people's heads were at the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The first Red Scare really did just put a shocking end to what at the time was a galloping radicalism on the American left and in the working class, when you had Socialist Party, million member socialist parties, and even more radical syndicalists, and then it was all gone. But yeah, in that moment, it really felt like borders were all going away.
And I guess in many cases in Europe, they sort of were. I mean, they were definitely being redrawn. So, you know, the idea that none of it really mattered, and that it was, it didn't matter if it was drawn along the language lines or the religious lines or whatever, I think that probably like influenced that moment. But then, of course, you know, imperialism won, I guess. Nate, I was wondering, are there any sort of threads of what we've been talking about that you wanted to pull on a little bit more or flesh out, where you think that something came up that we could have talked a little bit more about?
Well, you were sort of mentioning when you're talking about the globalist and sort of the EU social democratic sort of trade negotiations, things like that. It was interesting to see recently that Justin Trudeau's Canada, his government there, was sort of pushing for banning right-to-work laws and pushing for a minimum wage in their sort of trade deals with the U.S. and Mexico. So it is sort of interesting that even, you know, neoliberals like Justin Trudeau are sort of leaning on this. Obviously, it's a different context up in Canada, but and this isn't exactly, you know, what Matt's talking about in terms of having the working class actually engage in these negotiations. But it is interesting to see sort of a move in that direction.
Yeah. And I don't think anyone's expecting the U.S. Senate to ratify a trade deal with Canada that requires us to end right-to-work laws. What do you think, though, Matt, about the... I was kind of mentioning them in passing as examples, but I've read a lot of literature from the International Labor Organization, the ILO, which is, you know, it's fundamentally a sort of corporate friendly labor approach, and always has been since the 1920s. It's, you know, this tripartite, we have to have labor, government, and corporations involved. And so in that sense, it's unambitious. But like from the US perspective, I mean, the fact that they were pushing, you know, paid maternity requirements, maternity leave requirements, like decades ago, you know, more than half a century ago, and the United States still doesn't have that. You know, is that something as a short-term fix that's worth pursuing, you know, trying to get the U.S. up to these sort of standards based on these kind of internationalized standardizations?
Oh, yeah. I think that I think pointing out that it doesn't have to be like this and that other countries do better and that we don't have to have this sort of zero-sum thinking about it is very important to building the consciousness that will eventually sort of hopefully get past these capitalist nation state idea. And yeah, the first you need to, when people are applying the idea of meeting people where they are rightly, what they mean is meeting people at their material needs. And if you can say other countries do this better than us, other countries treat working people better than we do, and that the idea of trade negotiations can be, instead of about losing jobs, losing benefits, which is the only thing it's been about for 30 years, and be about gaining them, then the thinking about internationalism and the thinking about trade and the thinking about negotiating with other people, that changes. But that hasn't been on the agenda, as I said. That that's just not something that comes up. When people try to sell things like TPP, or when they were trying to sell NAFTA, they sell it in these very generic terms of, well, you know, you're going to have cheaper goods maybe, and it'll create jobs, or there'll be job training, or it's always in very nebulous terms. I mean, Obama spent his entire political energies of the end of his term trying to sell TPP. And I honestly do not remember, and I pay attention to this stuff, I barely remember anything he said in favor of it. I mean, if you want to be honest, he would have said, we're trying to, you know, get more leverage with Asian countries' economies vis-a-vis China. But in terms of how it would benefit Americans, I don't even remember what he said about it. But if you're talking about trade in terms of these people have, you know, paid leave, these people have maternity, we sign this deal and we get those too, all of a sudden trade doesn't mean the same thing it's meant for most people for the last 30 years.
One of the really interesting examples from the TTIP stuff has been that apparently cars sold in the U.S. have to have a lot more airbags than cars sold in Europe because no one buckles their seat in the United States. So I guess that's one area where maybe it would benefit to put one of the rare safeguards that we've put in, you know, put that into Europe. But yeah, for the most part, I mean, they were horrified over there about hearing about the pink slime stuff. And the fact that people were just able to be like, yeah, let's put this in school lunches in the United States. And over there, they were just like, what? What are you talking about? You're going to make us eat pink slime? Uncle Sam's going to come over here and force us to eat pink slime? No way. I'm not doing this trade deal. You know, and that sort of provoked this interesting backlash. But I don't know. I mean, I'm always sort of torn between like the, you know, think really big versus what's a very specific thing to work on right now. And they're not necessarily in conflict, but, you know, I'm always just so jealous, I guess, when I do this research on like all these, you know, EU requirements that are like, oh, you have to have this many days of paid leave and holidays don't count. That's a separate thing. And, you know, then you have the paid maternity leave and that's this long and, you know, all the sort of social welfare stuff. I guess also fundamentally it requires you to rethink like what the value of is in your economy that you're going for, because, you know, they'll always be like, oh, these lumbering EU countries that are growing so much more slowly than the US. And it's like, yeah, but they have higher per capita everything. So that's good. Like, why? I don't care how fast the economy is growing if the material needs are being met. But on the other hand, as you've said, I mean, the good examples in Europe also have like 25% youth unemployment and that sort of thing. So clearly they're not doing everything right either.
Well, and also speaking of broad changes that need to happen in concepts and the way we think about economy and politics is the concept of endless growth that is the unspoken undergirding assumption of all American economic thinking. That is something that has to be challenged. That's another sort of thing at the higher levels that needs to be challenged. But talking about the difference between local and broad stuff, I think that, yeah, they don't work in conflict if their motives are aligned and if the things are aligned. Like talking about the broader goals of changing the way we think about internationalism and borders and things like that, that can align very well with the smaller bore idea of changing the aims of trade negotiations between countries, because they sort of point to the same thing, and one suggests the other, and that's really what needs to happen, is that you need local activism and local issues being addressed that reflect a broader paradigm shift in the thinking about politics and the economy.
I guess the last question here is, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the options of dealing with climate change. And, you know, on this show, we've talked about some specific measures that could be undertaken, especially surrounding the oil and gas industry. What do you see as this sort of shiny, happy approach of like, what if the left could totally control how we responded to climate change worldwide? What kind of a society would that look like, broadly speaking?
Well, it would absolutely end fossil fuels as quickly as possible. It would redirect resources towards renewables as much as possible, as quickly as possible. It would shut down oil fields. It would shut down gas fields. It would absolutely basically end the carbon economy, because that has to end now to prevent the worst possible future. And that's something that will never happen in a capitalism, because capital seeks profit. There's profit in fuels. We're going to core out the earth. We're going to drill every last drop if there's money to be had there. And if money means something, it's going to happen. So the carbon economy has to be shuttered. That mass amount of resources has to be redirected towards renewables stuff. And then some more of that money has to be redirected towards ameliorating the worst impact of it in places where natural disasters have occurred, in places where food economies have collapsed. And that means that nationalism, as we understand it, will also have to be undermined significantly, because we have to be responsive across borders as quickly as possible. and we need to be operating off the assumption that everybody deserves to live on this planet.
All right. Well, that's obviously a much more positive vision than is being offered elsewhere by the neoliberals and the fascists. So that's what we're trying to push for. But Matt, thank you so much for coming on for our 200th episode of Arsenal for Democracy to talk about sort of the future of what a left-driven world might look like in the 21st century.
Thank you for having me.
And Nate, thank you for being here in studio as well.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Special guest, Matt Christman from the Chapo Trap House podcast. That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.